The reading this morning comes from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 9, verses 2 through 29. And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. And his clothes became radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good that we are here. Let us make 3 tents, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah." For he did not know what to say, for they were terrified. And a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud, "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him." And suddenly, looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them, but Jesus only. And as they were coming down the mountain, he charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So they kept the matter to themselves, questioning what this rising from the dead might mean. And they asked him, "Why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come?" And he said to them, Elijah does come first to restore all things. And how is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? But I tell you that Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they pleased, as it is written of him." And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them, and scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, "What are you arguing about with them?" And someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." And he answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him. And when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at his mouth. And Jesus asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. And it has often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." And Jesus said to him, "If you can, all things are possible for one who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, "I believe, help my unbelief." And when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, "Why could we not cast it out?" And he said to them, "This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer."
Well, Amanda, you guys, great job. Thank you. I think I'm up here with every form of backup technology we have. And I mean every. Although that's not because of the cold. That's because I got an old iPad and it's been on the fritz. Takes a minute to get all this going. Okay, so we're back in the book of Mark. Should I move forward? Would that help? Okay. We're back in the book of Mark. Our habit here at Christ the King is that in the fall, we tend to look at the Old Testament and ask the question of who is God. In the wintertime, from Christmas to Easter, we tend to be in the Gospels, saying, who is Jesus? Why did he come? And then from Easter through the rest of the year, we tend to be in one of the New Testament letters. And so we are now picking up where we left off last year. So last year we did the first 8 chapters of the Gospel of Mark. And if you remember, Mark's gospel, well, all the gospels, really, what they do is they put in front of you these questions. Who is Jesus? What did he come to do? And then how do you respond to that? Mark is very clear, and it really almost breaks down into the two halves. The first eight chapters of Mark give a very clear presentation of who Jesus is. So we saw last year, he's the Messiah. He's the Son of Man. He is God in the flesh. And we talked last year about what that meant. And it all climaxed in chapter 8 with Peter confessing that that was the case. Peter saying, yeah, you're the Messiah. You're the Christ. You're the one that we've been looking for. And then immediately there's this turn, this very shocking turn for the disciples especially, where Jesus immediately starts to teach them that the Son of Man, the Messiah, has to suffer, has to go to the cross. We'll be looking between now and Easter at the second eight chapters of Mark, in which Jesus accomplishes that purpose, in which he goes to the cross. So that's the structure of the book, and in a sense, it's the structure of this passage. It's the structure of the chapter that we just had read. There was a reason that we read that whole passage. It was a bit of a long one, and you could tell, I mean, there's kind of two distinct episodes taking place, either one of which could be a sermon by itself. But there's good reason to put them together. We see in these two passages very clearly depicted who is Jesus and what did he come to do. And then we have a section in which we can reflect on how do you respond to that. What does faith look like? What does it mean to follow after this one who is the Son of Man with all the power and the authority that implies, and yet one who is going to the cross, one who's come to suffer and die. Years back, there was a member of this church named Richie Sullivan. I don't know how many of you have been around long enough to remember Richie. He lives in Dallas now. He's a writer, mostly about music, big Mavericks fan. Every once in a while, I pick up on a bit of his writing. And there was this one year where he said this about Christmas. I think this had something to do with the war on Christmas. I don't know. But he said, the Christmas narrative is one that you can take or leave as true, but I cannot be convinced that Silver Bells Going Ring-a-Ling is a better story than the Godhead veiled in infant flesh come to drink death to the dregs. That's the story. That's the story that we began with Christmas and that we're now following as we go towards the cross this spring. So let's dive into this. The main point here of this passage, this is a passage for people who find faith difficult. You may find faith difficult as a non-Christian. You might be someone, and I've met people who have said, you know, faith looks like a good thing. It looks like a beneficial thing, but I just can't get there. I can't muster it in myself to be able to believe. But for Christians also, faith is difficult. Even for those of us who have confessed faith in Christ, it is difficult to sustain. When life is hard, when we're suffering, when we wonder if God truly loves us and is able to save us. This passage is for people who find faith difficult. And the main point of it is breathtakingly simple, is that when faith is hard, hard to muster, hard to sustain, the solution is simple. Ask. Just ask. There's an anecdote. I think I've talked about this before. It's at the beginning of Walker Percy's book. He calls it the last self-help book. It's called Lost in the Cosmos. Percy is a wonderful writer. But there's this one story in it, and it's kind of a science fiction story in which the Earth has become uninhabitable, and so the survivors have blasted off into space looking for a new home. And they approach a planet that appears to be inhabitable, and in fact is inhabited. And the inhabitants, the aliens, make contact with them, and they say, okay, before you land, we have a few questions for you. And they start asking them questions about humanity. So just what type of species, what type of creatures are you? And they get into the history of humanity and all the conflicts and the struggles. And they say, okay, it's very clear that as a species you've got some problems. And so our last question for you is, have you asked for help? And the humans don't know what to make of this. What do you mean, asked for help? We know we have problems, but we're getting better. We're making progress. We're making progress morally. We're making progress scientifically. We're getting better. And the aliens conclude from this, you clearly have not asked for help. Permission denied. They send them on their way. This passage is about asking for help. So let's take a look. First of all, the Transfiguration. The Transfiguration puts on display, if it weren't already obvious, that what Peter confessed about Jesus, that he is the Messiah, that he is the Son of Man, with all that power and authority, is true. What's happening here in the Transfiguration? Well, what you have to understand is all of the images that depict the presence of God, they're all coming crashing together in this one location, on this one person, on Jesus. So what do we have here? We have the we have his clothing shining. We have the fact that they're on the mountain, right? They're up on a mountain, like Abraham on Mount Moriah, like Moses on Mount Sinai, like Elijah, who's there too, up on Mount Horeb, which is actually another name for Sinai. They're up on a mountain. This is where God meets with people, where he has met with these people in particular, with Moses and Elijah. There's this radiance. It's brilliant. It's blinding. The disciples are terrified. There's the cloud, right? Remember, the cloud led the Israelites through the desert. It descended. It took up residence in the tabernacle, in the temple. Before the exile, the prophet Ezekiel saw that cloud departing, saw it leaving the temple. And that cloud hasn't been seen since. This is the first time in Mark that it's mentioned, that cloud depicting the very presence of God has returned. It's back for the first time, and it's back here on the person of Jesus. And then there's this voice from heaven that says, "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him." This is, if you think about, what do we last see Moses doing? Remember the last sermon we had in Deuteronomy? And we talked about who Moses was. That last sermon talked about his flaws to some extent because he wasn't going into the promised land. But it also reminded us, Moses was God's prophet. He was a prophet who spoke with God face to face. He was a prophet who asked to see God's glory and who got as close as any human being has to doing so, but couldn't, right? God had to hide him in a rock. He said, "You can't see my glory, but you can hear it." Right? So he hides Moses in the rock, and he passes by, and he declares his name, the Lord, abounding in love and faithfulness. Right? So Moses can't see the glory, but he could hear it. Well, now the disciples, Peter and James and John, they're seeing what Moses couldn't see. They're seeing what John was talking about when John, at the beginning of his gospel, said, "The Word became flesh, and he dwelt among us, and we saw him, full of grace and truth." Because the law came through Moses, but grace and truth comes in Jesus Christ. That's what the disciples are seeing. All of these images, all of these symbols that represent the very presence of God in their midst are now crashing together, located on the person of Jesus. And so, in that sense, it makes a lot of sense that Peter wants to build a tabernacle. He wants to build a tent, right? He wants to put up tents, because this is what you do. When the presence of God is dwelling in the midst of the people, you need a tent. God always met with his people in a tent of meeting. He would speak to them from this tent. And that tent was there because being in the very presence of God is not a safe place to be. Remember what God said to Moses up on that mountain? Right after the people had sinned that first time when they had turned away from him, he said, "You've got to go on alone, because if I go with you, I'm going to destroy you. I'm going to break out in your midst, and it'll be the end." And Moses intercedes for the people. He reminds God of his own promises, which, by the way, is a great model for prayer, to pray God's promises back to him and appeal to those. And God is faithful to those promises, and he goes with the people. But there's always this tent. There always has to be this covering. There always has to be this barrier between God and his people. And so it kind of makes sense that Peter thinks that's what we need right now. I mean, they are terrified, right? There's this brilliant light, there's this cloud, there's this voice, they are terrified. Part of what Peter might be saying is, we need to build a tent, and we need you to get in it, because it's not safe right now. And what he's missing, what he doesn't understand, is that Jesus hasn't come simply to dwell in a tent, to dwell in the midst of his people from behind a covering. He hasn't come simply to dwell behind a veil. Jesus has come to tear that veil in two. Jesus has come to finally solve the problem, the reason that there had to be that tent in the first place. Because see, as things stand, at this point in the story, there's no peace. God has come and has said, don't be afraid. He has said, I bring peace. But that peace hasn't been accomplished yet. There is enmity between God and man because Jesus hasn't yet gone to the cross. Jesus hasn't yet satisfied God's wrath. And so as things stand, there is a problem. There is enmity between God and man. Peter can't be in relationship with Jesus, can't be in relationship with God without some kind of a barrier. And Jesus has come in order to remove that barrier. And so they can't stay on the mountain. They can't just build a tent. They can't stay up there. That's why Jesus immediately starts talking about what it is that he's come to do. And this is the great shock. This is the great offense. He immediately starts saying, I have to die. Here he says the Son of Man should suffer many things. In chapter 8, it was the Son of Man must suffer many things. That's what I came for. I have come in order to suffer. I've come in order to die. So this transfiguration, it's tempting. Peter seems to be tempted by this. It's tempting to think that the transfiguration means you've arrived, that you're there, that all is the way things were supposed to be again. God is dwelling in the midst of his people again. But that's not what it means. They haven't arrived. In some ways, the journey is only beginning, because they have to come off of that mountain, and they have to go to Jerusalem, where the Son of Man has to suffer many things. If anything, what the Transfiguration tells us is just who it is that is making that journey, just who it is that is going to the cross, that it is God himself come to bear the sins of his people. I do love that line. There's a song by Sufjan Stevens called The Transfiguration. That's about this event. And there is this one line in that. He picks up on the fact that Moses and Elijah are standing there, and he says the prophecy and the legislation spoke of whenever he would die. That it wasn't just the prophets that foretold this, but it was the law that said that this had to happen. It's actually a solid piece of biblical theology on Sufjan Stevens' part to pick up on that. This is the upside-down gospel. And so they come down. So we've seen here who Jesus is. It's been confirmed in breathtaking graphic imagery that when Jesus said, when Peter said, you're the Messiah, you're the Son of Man, you're the one we've been waiting for, that's been confirmed. And now Jesus has talked about what it is that he came to do. And now they head down, and there's this second episode in which we're going to see something about how to respond to Jesus. And in all of what are called the synoptic gospels, so Matthew and Mark and Luke, the ones that kind of tell basically the same story in basically the same order, adding a few things here and there depending on who their audience is and such, they all put these events together. They all go straight from the transfiguration to this healing. So let's see what we can make of this. So first of all, the fact that what's presented here is a case of demon possession, that's presented just sort of matter of fact, that this was just a part of the world they lived in, that they understood that there were spiritual forces at work, and that what this boy was suffering from was possession by a demon. It's interesting, all of the commentaries that I looked at, all the commentators, ancient and modern, not just the modern ones, they all said, you know, this looks like a case of epilepsy, or whatever the ancient equivalent was, they would put it. They all said, you know, this looks like something that has a physical explanation. It has a medical explanation. Now, the modern commentaries tend to say, this is epilepsy, period, full stop. That's all this is. The ancient commentaries, I think, show a little more wisdom in saying, this is epilepsy. This has a physiological explanation. And there are spiritual forces at work. This is a medical problem. And this is one of those works of the devil that the Son of God appeared in order to destroy. And they don't feel any need to try to draw a line between those two things and pick out where one ends and where the others begin. They don't fall into this trap of this modern duality of mind or body, physical or spiritual. They just present this as something which is physical and spiritual, and it's not worth trying to tear those apart. Now, if you were here for the sermon last week that I just alluded to, because last week our text was from 1 John where it said the Son of God appeared to destroy the works of the devil. If you were here for the sermon last week, you know that epilepsy is not the only work of the devil that's in play here. That really what Jesus has really come to destroy is a much more significant work of the devil, and that's doubt. And we see what happens here. So, when Jesus breaks out and says, you faithless generation, so the Father says, I brought my son to your disciples. I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able. And Jesus answers, oh, faithless generation. That appears to be directed at the disciples. It appears to be directed at these ones who've been trying to cast out this demon, but without praying. We see this at the end, that they were trying to do it without prayer. As a side note, it is interesting, and I think it is hopeful to note that means that one of the things contributing to this man's doubt, wondering about the power of God, is the ineptitude of Jesus' followers. That is hopeful because I know that there are many for whom faith is a struggle because of the ineptitude of Jesus' followers. That is hopeful for me as a minister. That should be hopeful for all of us who want to bear witness to Jesus and who fail. But hopeful also for any of you who have struggled with faith and have said, faith looks good, but I'm not sure about the faithful. There is hope here in this passage. The disciples are trying to oust this demon on their own power without prayer, and that makes sense. Prayer often feels ineffective to us. It feels like it's not getting anything done. And so I think David Wells is right when he says that the only way that prayer ever flourishes in the church is when we believe these two things, that on the one hand, the world is not the way it's supposed to be, but on the other hand, ultimately, God is the only one who can do anything about that. And so we have to go to him in prayer. What's on display here is that our boast can never be in our own capacities, not in our wealth, not in our wisdom, not in our power. Our boast has to be in the Lord. And so it turns out to be this man, the father of this child, simply admitting his helplessness, that turns out to be the model of what faith looks like. The irony that's on display here is that those who believe that they have power, those who think that they have the capacity to change the world on their own without prayer, without admitting their need, in the end don't. And that it's those who instead, without preparation, without preconditions, simply call on the name of the Lord, simply ask for help, simply admit their need. Those are the ones who find in God the love of a Father who sent Jesus into the world to die for us when we were still his enemies, when we were still sinners, when we were the ungodly. Richard Lovelace, at the end of his book, Dynamics of the Spiritual Life, has this great quote that I know we've read before, but it's worth reading again. He says, "There is much evidence in our experience against the idea that we're children of God. But the faith that surmounts the evidence and is able to warm itself at the fire of God's love, instead of having to steal love and self-acceptance from other sources, is actually the root of holiness." And it goes on. We often don't read this part, but I kept reading. And this is worth reading as well. He says, presented in this context, even the demand for sanctification becomes part of the good news. Even the demand that we bear fruit becomes part of the good news, because instead of becoming a precondition, it becomes a promise of what God will do in those who call on his name. It offers understanding of the bondage that has distorted our lives and the promise of release into a life of spirit-empowered freedom and beauty. So let me see if I can draw two conclusions from this. The first thing is, as the reader, like I said, all the synoptic gospels in Matthew and Mark and Luke, you see the transfiguration and then you see this healing, right? And so in the reader, as the reader, what you're able to see is the power on display, and then the exercise of this power, and one flows from one right to the other. Mark does something unique, though, and this is actually pretty rare. We think that Mark was written first, and that Matthew and Luke are probably drawing off of him, and so it's actually a very rare thing to have something show up in Mark's gospel that's not in either Matthew or Luke or both. But this is an exception, that Mark and Mark alone records this interaction with the Father. The other Gospels record the healing, but they don't record this interaction with the Father, where Jesus says, all things are possible for those who believe, and the Father simply says, I believe, help my unbelief. They don't record that moment in which faith is expressed simply as an admission of helplessness, simply as a call for help, calling on the name of the Lord. We don't know exactly why that is. I think it has something to do, though, with the fact that this is Peter's gospel. If you remember last year when we talked about the Gospel of Mark, we think it's very likely that this is the story from Peter's perspective, that Mark was an associate of Peter, and that what Mark is writing down is something that Peter would have relayed to him. That's very interesting when you note how often Peter gets criticized in the Gospel of Mark. If this is Peter's gospel, he's very hard on himself. Why would Peter's gospel, why would Mark alone record this interaction with the Father? I think it's because if anybody knew what it meant to have to come to Jesus completely empty, with absolutely nothing to offer, from a position of complete helplessness, it would have been Peter. It would have been the one who denied his Lord three times and who somehow didn't fall into despair. But instead, when he saw Jesus on the beach, he didn't even wait for the boat to dock. He jumped out and he swam and he ran to his Lord, and he had nothing. He has absolutely nothing to offer. But he finds forgiveness. He finds restoration. He finds healing. Peter, if anybody ever knew how the mark of faith is to be able to run to Jesus when you have nothing to offer whatsoever, it would have been Peter. And I think that's why we have this interaction recorded here. But the other conclusion that I want to draw from this, I do want to answer the question that you might have to say, really nothing? Nothing is required. Nothing is required to deal with this problem of sin. Nothing is required to tear this veil into, to restore peace between God and man. One of the pastors in our network, as we had our weekly chat about the sermon, they shared with us something that Fleming Rutledge wrote about this passage. Rutledge wrote this book 2 years back about the crucifixion, and she has a little devotional. And in her devotional on this passage, she points out that when Jesus breaks out with this outburst, "How long must I bear with this faithless generation?" We actually know the answer to that question, because we know where he's going. He's going to Jerusalem in order to bear this faithless generation, in order to bear the disciples, Peter and James and John, and not only that faithless generation, but every faithless generation, including ours. He's going to the cross to bear your sin and mine, so that each of us can look at that and say, "He died for me. He gave himself for me." That's what was required. This passage, or this chapter rather, the juxtaposition of the power and authority and of the suffering, and the way John's gospel would say it, the glory revealed in the cross itself. It has kind of the same structure as the chapters of Isaiah. 52 and 53, where on the one hand, the servant of the Lord is high and lifted up and exalted, but on the other hand, immediately, he's the suffering servant. Immediately, he's the one who's pierced for our transgressions and by whose stripes we are healed. This is the story. This is the story, like I said, that begins at Christmas. A story of the infant God veiled in flesh, come to drink death to the dregs on our behalf. And it's a story that we're going to follow along all the way to the cross, because Jesus is the Lamb of God who comes to take away the sin of the world, the one for whom there's not going to be another sacrifice. You know, it's not going to be like when Abraham was on the mountain offering up his beloved son, and there was someone else to take the place of the beloved son. This is the Lamb. This is the one. This is the one bearing the sin of the world. And so from here on out, everything is focused on what Jesus has come to do. What's on display in this passage is the emptiness of human effort, but not the emptiness of Jesus. What's on display is the power of God to save, and what's on display in this passage is the love of God that sent his son into the world, not to condemn it, but that anyone who believes in him would be saved. And it's for that reason that we come to this table each week. If this is a passage about dependence, radical dependence, coming with nothing, it's hard to think of a better picture, a better sign to signify that reality than eating. Because we depend on food every time we come to it.